Okay, so I'm joined now by a very special guest and probably the most special guest we've ever had in the Tameside Radio Studios. We're joined by former Glossop Chronicle editor and honorary president of Quest Media Networks, to David Jones. So David, welcome. Thank you for coming back into the studio. It's good to have you.
No, it's my pleasure. Thanks a lot for inviting me back. It's good to be back and see all my old friends again.
So the news was announced a couple of weeks ago now that you were stepping back from your role as Glossop Chronicle editor. How long had you been editor for?
Well, I started on the newspaper as a junior reporter way back in the early 60s. I've done about 57 years, and I was the news editor of the North Cheshire Herald in Hyde, Bredbury and Romilly for about 10, 15 years. Mm-hmm. And then I moved back to the Glossop Chronicle, where I started my career, this time as editor. So, yeah, add another 15, 20 years onto that, and fair old stint.
A fair old stint. You said it best there. Now, you might deny it, but you're incredibly well-known throughout Glossop. I think everyone knows your name and your face. And when the news came out that you were stepping back, we asked people what they'd like to know about your career. A good chance to quiz David, as we put it. So we've got some questions that the public have sent in. So I think we're going to get straight into them, if that's okay. Now, you've not seen these, so you've not had a chance to prepare, so it's all going to be off the cuff. So first of all, Linda Walker would like to know, what's the most exciting story you've covered in all of your time at the Chronicle?
Yeah, yes, it's difficult to think of just one. Exciting. I remember when I worked in Hyde, I covered the National Front activities in Hyde. And one day which stands out was when Tameside Council gave National Front permission to hold a march down the middle of Market Street in Hyde. There was concerns about from the police, who expected some kind of trouble. So in the end, the council agreed that one man from the National Front, his general secretary, I believe, called Martin Webster, and he was given the go-ahead to march down from the top of Market Street to High Town Hall, carrying a Union flag. Mm. It made national news. Most of the shops on the high street, the front windows were boarded up. Obviously, they were worried in fact there was trouble. Helicopters were overhead in High Town Centre of the day of the march. And there were two factors. There were National Front on one side of Market Street and a group called the Anti-Nazi League on the other side. And there was a line of police, two, sometimes three deep. Wow. Keeping the different factions apart. What happened actually was Martin Webster started his walk from the top of Market Street, and as he walked past the police then surrounded him to make sure he was safe. And all the time you had the Anti-Nazi League shouting slogans against him, the National Front supporters on the other side. And they weren't only exchanging views, they're exchanging missiles. Now, the photographer, Frank Foster, and myself decided the best place to be would be right in the middle of the action. So as the police moved to surround Martin Webster, as he walked down, Frank and myself got in the middle of the police. Probably a mistake, because we realised then the only people the Anti-Nazi League and the National Front hated more than each other possibly was the police. So rather than directing these missiles at each other, they then directed them at the group of police. Wow. And Martin Webster. And of course, Frank and myself were in the middle of that lot. And you literally had to duck down and shield yourself behind the police to avoid the bottles and stones that were that were raining down upon you. So, most exciting, definitely most fearful.
Do you class that as a good day at work or a bad day at work? Was that exciting or did you worry at the time?
I worried a bit at the time, but I class that as a good day at work. Because you're involved in the middle of a newsmaking instance, whether it was good news or whether it was bad news. But that was the kind of news that you wanted to report because you were there in the thick of it.
Absolutely. I think that's about as in the middle of it as you can get, isn't it?
Well, yeah, thinking back, it certainly was.
So we'll move on now. If that's the most exciting story. Now, Ricky Grindod wants to know, what's your most memorable story? So is the one that sticks out to you that maybe wasn't quite as exciting as the National Front marching through Hyde, but one that sticks in your mind?
Yeah, again, there's been quite a few, but one of the most bizarre and possibly the most interesting ones for me was when we actually sailed in a little boat under Mottram Moor, while I don't know how many feet, but while traffic was roaring away overhead, we were on a channel underneath Mottram Moor, and it was to celebrate the anniversary of John Bateman, who was an engineer, and he was the man behind the churn of reservoirs in Longdendale.
That now make up, yeah.
So United Utilities wanted to celebrate the opening of the reservoir and to tie it in with John Bateman. So journalists and photographers were allowed to actually sail, I don't know if that's the right word or not, under Mottram Moor. And how it happened was, it went to I think it was Vale House Reservoir or Bottoms Reservoir in Tintwistle, and we climbed down a metal ladder, must have been 20 feet, something like that, to a little stone jetty, and at the side of the jetty was like a culvert of water going very, very quickly all the way down to a treatment plant at Godley. So there were little boats, maybe like, I suppose, coracles. Mm. And each boat had a journalist or a photographer in front and someone from United Utilities sitting at the back with, wasn't really an oar, it was like a piece of wood, because the culvert of water ran very, very fast all the way down to I say the treatment plant at Godley. Now, I'm a little bit claustrophobic, and we knew what we expected. The channel wouldn't be all that big. Mm. And in places it wasn't, because you could put your arms out at the side and touch the sides.
Oh dear.
And you could put your hands out at the top and touch the top. And before we actually got into the boats, we're all kitted up with helmets on, like a miner's lamp on the front of the helmet. And the guy from United Utilities said, "Oh, by the way, before you actually do this, could you sign this form?" And the form was almost like a disclaimer, saying, "If anything happened to you, you know,
wasn't their fault.
Tough luck, you know." So we're all in our respective boats. So we all went down, and it was fascinating because in places the culvert opened up and it was quite wide. Mm-hmm. And it was actually still in operation, because when engineers had to go down there to check whatever, they still went down. But I think what the most interesting part was, you could find like little ledges in the stone, and we were told by the people from United Utilities that's where the people who constructed the culvert put little lanterns and candles. Mm. And they actually worked with a hammer and a chisel in almost permanent darkness, wow, except from the light of a candle, to actually cut the culvert through the rock. That, I think, was around about 1850-something.
It's unbelievable. So, it's a real piece of history, isn't it?
Well, that's it. So I quite like that in a way. And the thought of it was, say, about, 30 feet, maybe more, maybe less, overhead, on one of the busiest trunk roads in Great Britain. Yeah. There was huge oil tankers, articulated lorries, plus vans and cars.
Could
and
you
buses.
Hear them above you, or was it so thick with rock that it was quite...
At times I felt I heard like a slight rumble. Because it was deathly quiet.
Wow. I think it shows how well they were built, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. And I often thought that United Utilities wanted me to add that into a tourist attraction. The number of people actually paid to actually go on that trip. So, yeah.
I think that's a good story to illustrate how lucky we are as journalists in this job. We get to do things that a lot of people wouldn't get to do, don't we? And we get to share that with them through the stories.
Yeah. Definitely. Oh, certainly. I can remember once, and again, it's going off a point, when this big circus came to Hyde. This is going back about 20 years, and I know times have changed because this circus had animals, elephants and lions and tigers. And because I work for the paper, I'm doing a story, they said, would you like to, to come through to meet some of the animals? Oh. So we went through, and one of the keepers brought out some tiger cubs, and they were in a wedge like little kittens, the cats we all have at home, and they were so playful. And there was one rolling on its back, and the keeper tickled its tummy, something like that. So I put my hand down, this little tiger went to lick my hand. So I just moved it away. And so the guy said to me, if you tried that with his tiger in about 18 months' time, it'd have your arm off. So I said, well, I won't be coming back in 18 months' time anyway.
Definitely.
But yeah, that's when you said we're lucky to go to places and experience certain things that a lot of people don't get the opportunity to do.
Definitely, and it still continues to this day, doesn't it?
It does. So,
moving on, we've got another question now, one that's more centred on Glossop. Jack Every would like to know, what's the biggest change that you've seen in the Glossop area over your tenure?
Yeah.
Now, obviously, it's changed from what would have been sort of a little village on the outskirts of Manchester to now almost part of the Greater Manchester conurbation, isn't it? I know it's in Derbyshire, but it's basically right up to the edge of it now.
Oh, yeah. Well, when I started, I said all those years ago, I think the population of Glossop was about 18,000, or Glossopdale, because that includes Hadfield and Charlesworth and Tintwistle. Now it's probably doubled.
Yeah.
That the mills, I remember, there was a textile mill, there was Ritz and Lux, where they made women's and children's clothing. They've closed many, many years ago. Ritz and Lux is now Howard Town Retail Park. What was a mill, they now turn into apartments.
So it's moved from industrial to a residential area of itself.
It is, yeah, because although Glossop is in High Peak, is in Derbyshire, it was always a mill town. Mm. In the old days, there was a cotton mill.
But it was well situated as well, wasn't it?
Well, that's it. And the flow of water down from the hills and the moors, where in the old days cotton mills needed that water to help in the process of, weaving and that kind of thing. I suppose the biggest change is it's turned into an industrial town, into a market town. And I think a lot of it is due to, obviously, the progression which is happening in all towns, plus the number of homes that have been built in and around Glossop.
Did that change the sort of news you reported? Did it move from maybe trade news to more residential and crime and things like that?
Yeah, I think Glossop has always been like a quiet, sleeper little town. Obviously, over the years, it's got busier and busier. Old established businesses have closed, new ones have moved in. Old shops have closed down. In a lot of cases, new ones have moved in. It's just the growth, the progress that has been made in Glossop over the years. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, it's up to the individual to decide.
Yeah, and you've stayed loyal to Glossop throughout, and you've lived there for many years now.
Oh, I've lived in Glossop for most of my life. It's my hometown. It's a town I love, and it's a town where I couldn't see myself moving anywhere else, to be honest with you.
Still fiercely proud of your Welsh heritage, though.
Oh, of course, definitely.
So, moving on now, we've got a couple of questions from Ryan Fitzpatrick. The first one is, he wants to know the most humorous crime story or police story that you might have covered over the years. Because obviously, police and crime stories can sometimes be very serious. We've covered a few of them, haven't we, in the past, where people have died and things like that. But is there any that have been on the lighter side?
I remember one particular story. Many years ago, the police used to invite us along to drugs busts and to call around at people's homes to see, to catch suspects.
Yeah.
We always used to have to report to Glossop Police Station at about 4 o'clock in the morning at the so-called Dawn Raids,
yes, many of us familiar.
And then obviously we're told where to go with the police. And I remember once we had to go to, it wasn't me who arrested them, obviously. We had to go to arrest someone in the Glossop area. And we all went up there, and there's myself and three policemen. So we went to this house, and before we got there, the police said, right, to me, you go with one officer to the back door of a house. The other two policemen will go to the front door, set your watches, and in 2 minutes' time, the guys at the front door would knock and shout, police. And you and the other police will be at the back door.
Waiting for them.
Waiting, just in case you run out that way, you see. So anyway, the policeman and myself went to the back door and we checked in 2 minutes. Now, someone's watch at the front door must have been off key. A
couple of seconds
so
out,
we
yeah.
weren't really ready at the back door, and all of a sudden, these two guys raced out. And the policeman said to me, David, don't you stay there. So he chased them down the road. I remember he's pouring down. So I'd waited there for about 2 or 3 minutes, getting soaking wet. So I thought, oh, I might as well go back into the kitchen and wait for him. And what I didn't realise, what I never thought, one of the people we were after had obviously circled back and come back into the house. So I was stood there in the kitchen, and all of a sudden this guy burst in who lived there, and he saw me. And I won't use what he said, but it was something like,
What are you doing here?
What are you doing here? And I just said to him, it's the first thing you say. And I said to him, I just with the police, sit down. And he sat down. And I thought, I was knocking on a bit then, and I thought he's surely going to say, yeah, not from the police, you know, but he never did. And he sat down, and thankfully, in 2 minutes' time, the policeman arrived back, and
Unbelievable. I think you probably got an assist on that arrest, definitely.
Well, that's fair. I think I arrested him, actually. I made him stay where he should have stayed.
Well, there we go. Maybe a career in policing just eluded you.
Oh, I might try that.
So a follow-up question to that. We had the news of the march earlier, but he wants to know, what was the biggest Glossop event that you've covered that's made it to national news? Because obviously we have had quite a few big stories, haven't we, over your tenure that have made it nationwide. What do you think is the biggest?
Yeah, well, I remember there was a siege in Charlesworth at an isolated farm. And a group of people who'd stolen a sizeable amount had holed up in this farm in Charlesworth. The first I heard about it, and it was a Wednesday morning, which was our, well, the last day for publishing a newspaper for that particular week. And a guy phoned up and he said to me, it sounds strange, this, but I've just seen three policemen walking out of the police station on Ellison Street in Glossop carrying semi-automatic, well, he called them machine guns. So put the phone down. I thought, yeah, it's a crank. About another 10 seconds later, the phone rang again. Somebody different, but with the same story. Police left Glossop Police Station carrying machine guns.
And that was when you knew that maybe something was afoot.
So anyway, I phoned up Glossop Police Station. This is years and years ago.
When we could do such a thing.
When we could do. We couldn't do it now. And I told the policeman what we'd heard. And I knew him, and he said to me, right, well, I can't tell you, excuse me, anything at all about it, but if you head through Charlesworth, you'll see
a scene unfolding.
You'll see a scene unfolding, and the road will be blocked. So I went along, and sure enough, through Charlesworth, please, you can't go any further. So anyway, luckily again, it was a policeman I knew. So he said, right, all I can say to you, turn left up this road, and
you'll get a very good view.
That's it. So anyway,
this is unbelievable to me, because we would never get this level of access now such a thing was happening.
Well, we wouldn't. So anyway, we went up this road, and it's a little country lane in Charlesworth, and again, another police block. And again, it was somebody I knew. So anyway, I told him, and he said, right, come here, come in this field. And again, it was a police inspector who I knew, I was quite friendly with. And he told me the same thing. And there was police all over the place. And, you know, there were some guys holed up in this farm. And the police, we'd always be trying to catch them. And at that time, the police didn't know, I don't think they knew anyway, whether the guys in the farm were armed or not. But as it turned out, I think they were armed. Mm. And it was getting close to our deadline, which was 12 o'clock on a Wednesday morning. So I had the photographer with me, and we said, we won't mind getting a photograph of this farm. So anyway, we had to wait for a couple of hours. And the police were inching ever closer to this farmhouse. And the inspector said, right, if you go along there, past this hedge, and eventually you'll be able to see the farm. Mm. But don't stick your heads up, just in case they are. They are armed. So anyway, we walked along, and there's a policeman with us, and he said, the photographer, right, stick your head up now, very, very quickly, a photograph, and then get down and crawl back.
Wow.
So he did, and we did. We got our photograph. We got, you know, a big story which went in the paper that week. What we didn't know until days and days afterwards was that the police had got so close, and they managed to get like a kind of a microphone system so they could hear what was going on inside the house. And apparently, as our photographer was getting up over the wall, looking over the wall to take a photograph, he actually, on the recording, this one of the guys said, hey, there's someone taking a photograph. And it was our chap. And we crawled back, went down to the office, and wrote the story up.
You managed to spook him, clearly.
Yeah. Wow. And of course, in those days, I think it was pre-computers, so we write our stories on typewriters and copy paper, which we then had to get sent down to our head office. And
the film would have had to have been developed for the photo. It's not a quick one, is it?
No.
No way. Unbelievable. And it's interesting how much everything's changed, hasn't it? The way we work now, that's definitely unbelievable. So let's move on now. And I think we've got a question coming up from Barry Matthews on something you'll know quite a lot about. So he says, you've been covering the issue about the Mottram bypass for pretty much all of your career. Can you remember when it was first talked about and what was planned?
Yeah, it was. I can remember it definitely in the 1960s. Mm. And the plan talking about bypasses and interconnecting bypasses and motorways. And the idea was to create a huge roundabout at Mottram, mm. which was there at the time, I think, and to create a bypass from Mottram all the way into Sheffield.
Which was the plan for the M67, wasn't it?
Because we already had the M67. I think it was in progress of being given the go-ahead, mm. and it was eventually built. So the idea was you'd use the M67, go on to the big roundabout in Mottram, get on another trunk road and get another bypass, and they go all the way into Sheffield. And that was 1960s. And I remember at the time, the cost was £3 million. And looking back in the 1950s, because I also do a nostalgia page,
yes, yeah.
And even the 1950s, they were talking about a bypass. And I read one story, and the Chronicle and the reporter was mentioning a piece from Fred Blackburn, and Fred was then the MP for Stalybridge and Hyde. And in the mid-1950s, Mr Blackburn was promising a bypass from Mottram to Sheffield in 3 years' time.
Wow.
And that must have been mid-1950s.
Unbelievable.
Motorway would have cost £3 million. And now we're talking about
hundreds of millions of pounds, yeah, for a stretch of road that's not a motorway from, no, Mottram to just a little bit further down the road.
That's it, to Hollingworth, yeah.
Unbelievable. Well, it's certainly one that's dragged and dragged. Will you be glad to see the end of it?
I think I will.
Will it be the end of it? Who knows?
I won't be convinced that we're going to have a bypass until I see the earth movers arrive and one of them grabbing the first chunk of turf from wherever.
It's certainly been a story that's ran and ran, hasn't it?
It has, yeah.
So we'll move on now to Tanya Evans, and this is quite a nice one. I like this one. She wants to know, can you remember the first story you ever wrote for the Glossop Chronicle, or one of the first stories? You remember your first days?
I remember the first day. The first story I wrote in the Chronicle was from a local hairdresser who was leaving Glossop after about 15, 20 years, and all his customers had bought him a present. Mm. And he asked for a mirror, which, you know, I thought, well, I suppose hairdresser, he's moving to another...
Helpful.
Yeah, helpful. But it's quite funny, after my first day, which I thought I'd done reasonably well, and my editor, who was called Mike Swibley, who was a lovely man, sadly no longer with us, and Mike said, oh, can you hang on a little bit? So I said, yeah. And he said to me, oh, by the way, you won't be in the office tomorrow. And I thought, well, I've done nothing wrong. You know, I've behaved myself and I've made a good impression. So I said, oh, what's that, Max? He said, oh, he said, it's a tradition every year. Glossop Rotary Club take a group of male old age pensioners on a trip to the seaside. I said, oh, yeah. He said, and again, it's a tradition that a photographer and a reporter from the Chronicle always goes with them. He said, so would you like to go? And I thought, that's not bad.
That's not a bad second day,
yeah,
is it?
Second day, you know, day out at, I think it was Southport, I think, wow, we went to. So myself and a photographer met outside what's called the Old Men's Corner in those days on Market Street in Hyde. Set off on a coach to Southport. So we went and we had breakfast and we had meal midday, we had afternoon tea,
wow,
all paid for by presumably the Rotary Club. I was also given about £5 expenses from the from the Chronicle. That's on my second day. And I thought, well, I've chosen the right career.
Yeah, it's not a bad job.
After
this.
All, second day, day of the sick side, you know, and getting a suntan and this, that and the other and free meals. Mm. And, you know, I think about £2 is fine, it'd been £5. Expenses thrown in, which I don't spend a penny of anyway.
Like you say, what a way to spend your career. And a nice memory there. And
lovely memory, yeah.
Yeah, one that's good to remember. So I've got another question now here from Vicky Dean. And she wants to know, what was it that made you choose journalism? Because you said there it was certainly a right choice for a career for you, wasn't it? What was it that made you want to get into the industry?
Well, as long as I can remember, I'd always wanted to be a reporter from about 14 years old. I was so keen because I realised at the time that if you want to be a journalist, although we just called them reporters in those days, you needed shorthand. Mm. So I remember my mother knew someone who was a shorthand teacher. So every Thursday night at about 6:30, I'd done my homework from school and I'd go along to this shorthand teacher. And he'd be teaching mainly a group of young women who wanted to be shorthand typists. And I was the only lad there and learned Pitman's shorthand. So I did that until I was about 16, and I told my careers advisor at Glossop Grammar School, which he attended, the career I wanted. And he was almost dismissive, as if to say, oh, you got no chance, lads, you know. So anyway, I was still keen to do it. So when I left school at 16, didn't go to university because in those days you had to go out earning.
Yeah, you wouldn't have gone to university in those days for journalism, would you?
No. So I remember contacting the Chronicle and there's no vacancies at the time. So I went to work at a cannery in Glossop called Pickering's. So worked there for about 18 months. I must admit, I got sacked from there.
What dare we ask why?
Yeah, I was useless at maths. And in fact, I remember once when I was at school, we did it for my algebra exam, and I got 4%. And I remember saying to my teacher, why have I got 4%? Because I looked at my paper and I got big red crosses against everything I'd written. And he says, well, Jones, grace marks for spelling your name right at the top of the paper. So I thought I could hack it as an office junior where mathematics and calculations played a huge part. No idea. So I was found to be totally useless at that job. Why it took him 18 months, I've no idea. So I got sacked from there. Then I went on to work for Dinting Printworks in the laboratory, where again, I was totally unsuited for. And then one day I'd done about 2 or 3 years there. I liked it, but you know, I wasn't all that good. And I tried once again to get a job on the Chronicle. Wrote a letter, got a reply back, and they said, yeah, there's a vacancy. Can you come for an interview? Wow. So I went for an interview. I had to do 6 months probation, as they called it. I was then accepted, and we had to go to day release to a journalism college, St. John's in Deansgate, Manchester.
Mm. I guess that was the last job interview you had.
It was, yeah. And so that was that. And so I started when I was 20 in May, as I would be 21 in August, and I've been here ever since.
Here ever since, and we've loved having you here, definitely.
Ah, it's been a pleasure. I've loved it, every minute of it.
I'd be interested, because you've been in the business longer than most. What's been the biggest change that you've seen over the time in journalism?
Yeah, well, I would think in journalism, the change over from the old technology of actually producing a newspaper to what we still call new technology. In the old days, we had to we typed out stories on copy paper, which was okay. And then those stories had to go to the print department in Ashton, where the what we'd written in story form on paper, we were turned into hot metal, and there's a whole process of contometers and people who then created a newspaper. But it was laborious. It took ages. And also what we had to do, once we got our stories, people who worked in outlying offices like myself and Max Willey did at Glossop, we then had to send our stories down to Ashton, where the production team could turn them into stories for the paper. And in Glossop, that meant putting the written stories in an envelope and sending them by bus to Ashton. And what we did, we had a contract with the bus company, paid them so much, and they'd do that. So we would be given to a bus conductor, or if there's no bus conductor there, put them in a little shelf in the bus. Then we'd phone up Ashton office and say, I'll just put a parcel on the 9:30 236 bus at Glossop. It'll be in Ashton at about half an hour. And then whoever we spoke to would then go and collect them from the conductor. It went pretty well until one day I did that, phoned it through, but the conductor wasn't there. He'd gone for a brew, whatever. Anyway, about half an hour later, I had a phone call from the person I'd spoken to and said, I've waited for the bus coming from Glossop to Ashton and there's no parcel of copy. So I said, well, put it on the bus. I've no idea what happened to it. I said, what I'll do now is I'll go back to the bus station and find out what's happened to it. And my colleague, Max, and myself walked up there, and there were a crowd of people stood at the side of the bus station and a couple of policemen there. So Max, myself, went up, and Max said to them, what's wrong? And this is the time of the IRA troubles. Oh. And the policeman said, we think there's a suspicious parcel actually on the floor in the middle of the bus station or the bus terminus, which then was outside the Norfolk Arms in Glossop. So we looked, and what suspicious parcel was our copy. And apparently the conductor had seen this and just threw it out, and the bus had gone, you see, then. So Max and myself said, we know what it is. It's our copy. So we said, all right then. So we walked across, picked the parcel of copy up, and of course people thought we're picking up an unexploded object, you see. So Max and myself walked back, and I think Max said, it's okay, just Glossop Chronicle stories. So I can imagine that, you know, these days writing your story and put him on a bus to go down.
Unbelievable, isn't it? How did you find the change of technology? Because obviously when I worked with you, you were fantastic on computers, took your own photos, managed to adapt to everything. How did you find it?
It was difficult at first, and of course, going back to the days of what we call hot metal, there was a complete diversification between the unions. Journalists weren't allowed to pick up any of the pieces of the metal copy, and if you did that, you could have a strike on your hands. Mm. So we had to be very, very careful what we could do or what we couldn't do. But it took a bit to get used to realising that what we typed out on our computer, and we could see it on a big screen in front of us. And you take it for granted these days. That's what happens, you know. You don't even think about it. But, yeah, producing papers in the old days, it took about three or four times as long, because the actual story that you'd written had to go through.
It took a lot more people to get it on the page.
A heck of a lot more. And, of course, a lot of the people who'd actually worked on the actual physical method of creating that, they were all good friends, and of course they lost their jobs.
An industry died.
It died so on its feet, yeah, in a matter of weeks or months.
Unbelievable, really, isn't it? Well, I mean, it's been lovely to talk about and reminisce about, you know, your time at the Glossop Chronicle. And obviously, you'll always be a part of the Glossop Chronicle. How much have you been enjoying retirement? Have you got any plans? What sort of things are you looking forward to doing?
Yeah, I think spending more time with my family, in particular my grandchildren. Looking back, I probably realise I maybe didn't spend as much time with my two sons when they were growing up as I should have done, mainly due to work commitments.
It's a busy job, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And for months and months now, I thought, well, I'm not going to let that happen with my grandchildren. So I've got two boys, one 16 and a half, one grandson who's 8, and a granddaughter who's 13. So, yeah, I'm spending time with them, taking them out and, having a good time. I've got a border collie, which needs taken out, umpteen times a day.
The people of Glossop will still see you walking the dog.
And I'm still stopped and people say nice things and people tell me about stories, which I then feed to yourself and the rest of my colleagues and friends on the Chronicle and Reporter and Quest Media.
Definitely. David, it's been a pleasure to have you back again. Always good to chat. You're welcome back anytime you want. Always welcome on our airwaves. Thank you very much.
No, it's my pleasure and thanks again, Lee.